Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm your host, Phil Huff, this morning, and with me today we have Bruce Smith, who longtime listeners will recognize from past morning shows. Bruce has been on and spoken about wild mountain goats, about climate change, and about some of the books he's written. He is a retired wildlife biologist. I'm going to let him go into his history a little bit, and an author who has turned in recent years to writing children's books, and that's what we're here to talk about mainly today. Is the third in a trilogy of books called The Legend Keepers. This one's The Promise, and it's due out this week, and we'll hear more about that from Bruce in a moment. But Bruce, why don't you say hello to the audience and go into a little bit about yourself, your background as a biologist, and how really all your life you've been training to be an author.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Phil, to talk to your audience again. And yeah, some people may have recalled me from past times when I've been on the show, but that's been a while. So I live in Bozeman, Montana. Been in Montana or Wyoming largely since 1970. What brought me to the West from where I was born and raised in Michigan was to finish my bachelor's degree at the University of Wyoming in wildlife biology. And then I went on, got a master's there. That project, the research for that degree, involved living in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness area for 2 full years studying mountain goats, something I still fondly look back on. And then I went on to a professional career, worked for the federal government for 30 years, worked for several agencies at first because I had short-term jobs, the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Park Service. I kind of covered most of them that do that type of work. And then eventually got a permanent job in Lander, Wyoming, kind of in the center of the state. I was the first wildlife biologist to work on the Wind River Indian Reservation. I was invited there by the Shoshone and Arapaho tribes to develop a wildlife management plan for that huge piece of beautiful country that's the size of Yellowstone Park. And then after I finished that several years working with the tribes, I moved to Jackson Hole and was the biologist at the National Elk Refuge for 22 years. And that was my last job with the federal government. And after that, moved to Montana, back to Southwest Montana, and did some consulting work. But mainly, I've been a full-time author, environmental educator for the last 20 years, I guess, since I retired.
So what was the motivation for turning from a wildlife biologist, a field biologist, a planner, administrator, to an author?
Good question. When I was a kid growing up, going to school, I not only didn't like to write, I didn't like to read. I just wanted to be outside. There was a marsh behind our house. That's where I spent a lot of time, out in my boat. I build little boats and so forth. But then I think it was in eighth grade, I had an English teacher, Mrs. Cullen, and she made a real impression on me. And I think it's because she took a special interest in me, or I thought she did, and encouraged me to read and to write. And my gosh, it kind of worked because I started reading books then, mostly about the sea, Moby Dick and Treasure Island and Robinson Crusoe and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And that kind of stimulated me to want to write because I thought I can do that too. So I started just sort of writing for myself and for school projects. And then during my professional career, of course, I did a lot of writing for scientific journals, publishing my work. On the side, I did writing for magazines starting way back in the early 80s. And then when I was going to retire from the federal government, I decided I wanted to write for a much broader audience and about bigger topics. So that's when I started writing books, as well as writing magazine articles.
We had you on years ago to talk about your coffee table book on mountain goats, Life on the Rocks, which was fabulous. And so some folks here may be familiar with that, but tell us about some of the books you have written and the topics covered and the progression, if you will, of your career as an author.
Okay. The first book I wrote, I didn't intend to write. I was still working for the National Elk Refuge in Wyoming, Jackson Hole. And it was a year before I did end up retiring. The Elk Refuge, along with Grand Teton Park, was involved in developing an environmental impact statement on management of the elk herd, the largest elk herd in North America, or one of them anyway, and the bison herd there. And for that, we needed a lot of background information. And one of the projects I took on was writing about habitat changes on the National Elk Refuge over the 100-year history, from 1912 when it was established up till then. And it was going to be sort of an addendum, a report at the back of the EIS that would be referenced in the EIS. And it became a bigger project and a bigger project. And that ended up being my first book, Imperfect Pasture, A Century of Change at the National Elk Refuge, which kind of documents both in photographs and studies and text how the vegetation changed there over 100 years, why it changed, and the consequences of that for wildlife. So that ended up being a book. I didn't think it was going to be a book. It was my first one, and it kind of got me more interested in writing more books. So the next one, and all of my nonfiction books, all five of them have to do with my career or my love of nature and that sort of thing. The next one was about the time I spent on the Wind River Reservation. That book's titled Wildlife on the Wind. It's about my 4 years working with those two tribes, the Shoshone and Arapaho. And I wanted to write that first because it was the first reservation I'm aware of where a wildlife management, a technically based, biologically based wildlife management plan was written for all of the 500 plus reservations, or 300 plus reservations, I should say. And so I wanted to do that as a blueprint for other reservations. I also wanted to do it to honor the Shoshone and Arapaho people. I came to know them while I was there. Some of them became my friends, and I just developed a real admiration for these native people and how they take care of the land and think long term about future generations. As they say, think about 7 generations and ahead. So that was the second book. The third one was Where Elk Roam, which is about my 22 years working with the Jackson Hole elk. Basically covers everything from nuts and bolts about biology and management and biopolitics and how wildlife populations are managed, what drives that, and it's not just science. And that came out in 2014. And then the book you referred to, Life on the Rocks, A Portrait of the Mountain Goat, came out in 2016. And I wrote that because of just my fascination with mountain goats. And I've continued to do work with mountain goats, write about mountain goats. But there's only one book written for a general audience about mountain goats before that. My friend Doug Chadwick, who writes a lot for National Geographic, published a book on mountain goats in 1983. And I wanted to write a different type of book about goats with a continental perspective and including a lot of my photographs I'd taken over the years. So that came out. And then a couple of years later, the book Stories from a Field, which is a collection of essays about my time working with wildlife or even as a hunter and that sort of thing.
I think you're referring to A Beast the Color of Winter.
Yes.
Has a fabulous title and is a wonderful book. And Doug is a great author. And always the trick with writing about science for a general population, for the layman, is to not get too much into the scientific detail and tell that compelling story, the narrative, and then to make the leap from a work of science that has a narrative to a work of fiction that embodies it. That's a really true art form. And that I think is the what you're trying to do with the trilogy you wrote. I'm hoping I'm putting that right, but maybe we should explore what created the pivot into you to start again with the series of the trilogy, The Legend Keepers, and Write for Children.
Yes, I had been writing nonfiction all my adult life practically. I didn't have another nonfiction project that, really was compelling me to write another book. But and I hadn't planned to switch from writing adult nonfiction books to writing for kids. I had no prior experience writing fiction or for kids. But when I was on a book tour for my nonfiction book, Life on the Rocks, that we were talking about, I was disappointed that few kids were ever at my book events as I traveled around. Their parents and their grandparents just didn't bring them. Even though publicity for the event said, this is a talk for the whole family with lots of pictures of animals, which I projected as part of the talk. And it just hit me. Near the end of my first book tour for that book, it just hit me that I needed to write a story for kids. I'd talk directly to them, or rather, the characters in my novel would talk directly to them, because I wanted to address the issue of climate change in a way that was exciting to kids, entertaining, but also educational, and maybe could empower them. So that the book wouldn't sound preachy, which nonfiction can, especially with adults talking to kids, I chose to write fiction and wrap the climate theme in a grand adventure at the roof of the world. And initially, it was going to be one novel. And I know you've read the first one, the second one, and now you've read the third. Originally, it was going to be one novel, but as I was writing it, I realized there was a lot more there than I realized at first.
Yeah, I think it worked really well broken into threes, but you've led to one of the questions I have is why not put them all together into one big book? Just too heavy, literally, physically to pick up, or
Yeah, like Life on the Rocks. When you write for a particular audience, in this case, middle grade kids, which is largely 8 to 12 or 13 year olds, there's relatively a formula for doing that. The vocabulary you use, the concepts that they can understand, but also the length of the books. And most middle grade books are anywhere from 25,000 to 40,000 words. And my books are at the upper end of that. If I would have combined all three of those, with the exception of somebody like J.K. Rowling, I couldn't have sold them.
They would be long. They would be hard to fit into the school year. I really truly enjoyed all three books, and I think as an adult, a lot of adult friends I've shared it with have enjoyed them. And so while we talk about them being written for children, they can have that clear focus. I think you have found great mastery of that art of making it a book appealing to adults as well.
Well, I hope so. And I don't know for sure, but I think as many adults as young people have read the first two books in the series. I get feedback from adults. I don't get feedback from kids except when I do school visits. And I like to do school visits after the kids have it read at least one of the books, so they have a little more background because my interaction with them, my presentations, and then especially the question and answers, I think are a little more productive that way. But the books, even though they're written for a middle grade audience, I read tons of middle grade now.
Yeah.
And Good middle grade is almost written on more than one level, so adults can enjoy them just as much and learn from them just as much.
Without giving too much away here, but it would seem there's obviously some of you imbued into the main character, Garson, who's heavily influenced by his eighth grade science and English teachers.
Yes, and one of the things about writing fiction, it's hard to write characters from just raw plot. Almost all characters for an author will have traits, quirks, whatever, appearance, characteristics from people they know. And very often in a novel, the author's personality or something about them will be in one of the characters. And you're right, there's things about me that are in Garson.
I have to go back and reread it now with that lens on. But I think is a unique talent, a rare talent at least, that an author can invest so much in a really compelling story. The narrative helps move things along and keeps the reader engaged, and yet you're learning about the science of glaciers and mountain goats and climate change and ravens and marmots along the way without really realizing perhaps you're even learning those things. And I'm sure that's intentional. Tell us a little bit about how you approached the topic as a writer, and balancing the story with the information you're trying to get across.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. I wanted readers to experience the climate crisis, a topic and very important to me. It's become very important in the last 10, 15 years. I wanted readers to experience that through the eyes, the dialogue, the thoughts, the very lives of animals who live its consequences every day. We don't think about that much. We know how climate events affect us, but most of us go on with our daily lives without thinking about the other 9 million species out there that are also affected in some ways by these climate events. And in my mind, animals serve kids as trusted teachers, whether they're domestic or they're wild animals. Show me an 8 or 10-year-old that isn't fascinated by animals, whether they're wild or domestic, their pets or the deer they see. And so the mountain goat is a perfect gateway species to the climate crisis because it lives at higher altitudes than any other large mammal in North America. And it's at those highest altitudes, as well as the highest latitudes, the polar regions, that the planet is warming fastest. In fact, at the top of the mountains where I live, the climate's warming at least twice as fast as the global average temperature rise. And so species living up there have to adapt fast if they can. So Buddy, the heroine, mountain goat kid of the first book, this orphan female mountain goat, she kind of leapt from the pages of my nonfiction book, Life in the Rocks, as a very logical main character for that first book. I adapted the cha in a sense, I adapted the chapter on climate change in Life on the Rocks. There was one chapter addressing that, that explains how global warming is affecting alpine creatures into the story for young readers. That wasn't again, nonfiction. It was a real story with real characters that I created in my mind. And this charismatic central character, Buddy, was an easy choice. And I also chose her as a protagonist, of course, because of my fondness for mountain goats. I know a lot about mountain goats, so I didn't have to do a lot of research. I already had a good feeling for how mountain goats behave. The only thing that you do in fiction when you're writing about animals, and you can do all the research on what's known, your own or others, but there are these things that we would like to know about animals or we imagine about animals, then you can fold in, and that's the fantasy part of it, the fictional part. And so the dialogue and the thoughts and the interaction are what you create. The other main character, of course, is Garson, and although the 12-year-old boy, and although Buddy does know that things are changing on her mountain, she doesn't know why, and the other mountain goats still don't know why. They just know, looking back, that things are changing. So to explore the climate crisis more deeply, human characters needed to join the story. And that's when Garson and some of his friends and his mother show up in the second book, The Partnership. They needed to join the series so that I could bring more depth and layers to the story and get into why the climate's changing, the thing that the animals didn't know. What are the manifestations of that? And then what can be done about it? Because that's really the most important part about the climate crisis is what can we do to stem it, to stop this rapid warming of the environment and all the cascading effects from that. So Garson was an introverted boy. He just didn't fit in. He didn't have friends. He was in a new community. He didn't fit in at school, and he and his mom moved to this new community. And of course, you know from reading that second book that his father had gone missing. And they didn't even know his mom, and he didn't know if his dad was alive. And so this kid had lots of issues to deal with. And he didn't really want to get involved in sports or anything. Then one day, something turned him on, and it was a school science project at the spring science and art fair that he went to with his mom. And there was one of these papier-mâché volcanoes, and on top was this white thing. And the student who had made this, a year older than him, Kira, was explaining it. And Garson said, "What's that white thing up by the top?" And she said, "Well, that's a glacier." And he said, "Well, there can't be a glacier there. There's all that magma inside." Well, Kira's science teacher, the one who would be Garson's teacher next year, was standing there and overheard it and started explaining to Garson that a lot of volcanoes have glaciers. They just don't happen to be active. And so Garson got interested in glaciers, and he just started reading everything he could about them. He Googled what he could. And then he decided to do a sixth grade science project on the glacier that was in the wilderness area near his home. And when he went up there to do this study, which actually was a repeat of his science teacher's project 40 years earlier when he was working for the US Geological Survey, he bumped into Garson. And their lives became entwined through this mutual interest in what was happening to the glacier and to Buddy's home. And that's the way then that the book is able to explore more deeply the climate crisis.
It's a wonderful example of the serendipity in all of our lives, how some small chance encounter or interaction can take us in a whole new direction. And it works very well on many levels. How did you come to choose this story, these themes, these characters?
Well, the characters were sort of the character Buddy because at first I didn't know there would be human characters because there wasn't going to be a second book. But the character, this orphan female mountain goat, was the springboard for it as a way, as I said, a gateway to delving into the climate crisis in a way that kids could relate to it and understand it. In having to bring in human characters to explore this more, it just became a very natural way of having kids also see this through the eyes of humans, someone their age. And in a sense, these two characters live parallel lives. And this provides readers both a boy and an animal to root for that make great role models for them.
It's a great exploration of relationships in general. The various human interactions and relationships, and the various interactions with other animals Buddy has, and then the natural, it seems, relationship that Buddy and Garson develop, and it all works really well. It has lots of lessons for us all. Do you find that the adults or students come to the naturalness of the mountain goat and Garson having Buddy and Garson developing this bond or this friendship more naturally, or do they struggle with it?
Well, the school visits I've done so far, which is where I have contact with those young readers, none of the kids had read the second book. They'd only read the first one. So I can't really address how they felt about Garson and his teacher and his friends and so forth. But I can tell you the kids love the
Love
animal characters. And they asked me who's my favorite. And of course, I turned that around and asked them. And it's amazing. They all have different favorite characters for different reasons. And I like to ask them why. And it brings out the most interesting things about that. That is fun for me to hear their comments and their responses to having read the book. But on a more serious note, one of the underlying reasons why you decided to write the book and then the series is that kids are really starting to feel stressed about the climate crisis. You know, they're smart, they see and hear and read about. So I was saying one of the underlying reasons for writing this story, a more serious one, is that young people are feeling stressed about the climate crisis. That's a growing problem for kids. I mean, health-wise, they're much more vulnerable to some of the effects, whether it's air quality, you know, if they live particularly in poor communities, underserved communities, trying to respond to the effects of hurricanes and floods and so forth, it's a real challenge. And there may not be the money to react to what's happening. But on another level, in mentally and emotionally, kids are suffering from this. You can almost think of it as the way kids are feeling about going to school and wondering if somebody's going to walk into school with a gun and shoot them. It's ever present. They may not talk about it. You may not be able to actually see it, but that doesn't mean it isn't internalized and it doesn't affect them in ways that we may not be able to even observe or understand. And so these kids, you know, are smart. They see, hear, and read about what's happening with the climate crisis. And they have their whole lives ahead of them, decades ahead of them, which means compared to you and me, Phil, and people our age, they're going to experience much worse consequences of the climate crisis than you and I will. In fact, there was an article in one of the issues of Science Magazine, I think it was in late 2022, and the authors were addressing this subject. And their projections are that today's six-year-olds will experience in their lifetimes three times as many climate-induced events as their grandparents will. And on average, those events, whether they're fires, floods, hurricanes, disease pandemics, which are going to increase as a result of climate change, famines, droughts, all of that, on average, they'll be more severe than what we're experiencing now, too. So kids are experiencing what psychologists now call eco-anxiety or climate grief. And I wanted to be able to, in a way, express that in these books. And you see that in some of the human characters there, as well as the mountain goats. So the good news is that young people are taking action. They're actually leading the way because they feel like adults are failing them, which I don't take issue with. So, you know, whether it's lawsuits that are being brought, like the one in Montana, held versus the state of Montana, the first one of its type that actually went to trial, and the students won. It's being appealed now by the state of Montana. or they're taking action in other ways, all sorts of ways, starting with Greta Thunberg's, protests on the parliament steps in her home country of Sweden, Stockholm. They're leading the way. And what I wanted to do with my writing is to nourish those aspirations and that activism of kids. So that was another part of writing the book, the motivation.
All three books, but really, especially books one and two, certainly underscore the urgency of the climate crisis. What is interesting, and I think completes the trilogy nicely, is book three does offer us a pathway out. It offers some hope for the future, if you will. And without giving much more of it away, if you want to elaborate a little bit on that and how that completes the arc, I think that was a very interesting part of reading the third book.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And of course, after the second book, there's a whole bunch of loose ends that needed to be tied up to
Yeah.
create sort of a satisfying conclusion to all of this.
Clearly, by book two, you're thinking book three is on its way.
Yeah, right. Okay, he's got to have another one. We can't leave it like this. A lot of books about the climate crisis, especially adult books, even YA books, are sort of dystopian. They don't paint a very rosy picture of what the world's going to look like in 50 years or 100 years. I wanted to write a hopeful book and a book of empowerment. So after kids read it, they felt like, I can do something. In my life, I can do something. It may be small, it may seem inconsequential, but my view is that it's a whole lot better if you do something than nothing. And when we join together, the way Buddy and Garson did in a partnership, we can accomplish way more than we thought we could. So that was my goal, is to write a hopeful book with characters that were engaging, that serve as role models. And you're right, the story points out how you can accomplish things. Garson in particular, and with his friends, family, and teacher, do that.
It's a fabulous cap, the promise. And book three, The Promise, is due out this week. I believe it's being released.
13th, yes.
Yeah. So fabulous. And do you have a short reading, a favorite passage, or something you'd like to share with the audience from the book?
Sure. What I could do is I could read the first page from the book and then a very short passage after that. So about a page and a half total. The first one has to do with Buddy, this orphan female mountain goat, and her adoptive mother. Her name is Oreo, so it's about them. And they have left their home mountain, which is called Goat Mountain, coincidentally. And they essentially are climate refugees. And Buddy has this mission, this charge that she's been given to save her band of goats from this great peril called the Great Warming. And so she has struck out with her adoptive mother to a new place where goats have never gone before, hoping they find a better home. Buddy didn't know it would be so hard. Finding her band of mountain goats a new place to live was proving complicated and dangerous. She and her adoptive mother, Oreo, were leaving Shining Mountain. When they arrived at their ancestral home on Goat Mountain, they'd faced their biggest test. She knew it. Oreo knew it better still. They'd need to convince the members of their band to leave and travel to a new home they had never seen. Buddy had explored Shining Mountain and found that it would provide a refuge from the hardships of the Great Warming. Meltwaters from its summit glacier fed gardens of tasty and nutritious grazing. Yes, Shining Mountain would make a fine new home. But there was this new problem. There was a band that was living there, the Shining Mountain Band. The band's matriarch, the one who ruled the roost, did not want a new band invading her mountain. Each band has its own home, the matriarch mystic had told Buddy that morning. We have enough resources for ourselves. For how long, I don't know. You can make do with what you have. And then a little farther into the book, and there's sort of alternating chapters, as you know, between Buddy's perspective as the narrator and Garson's. So this is back where we have Garson as the narrator. An image of a fluffy, four-legged animal with black nose and pointy horns popped into his head. It seemed to happen whenever Garson was having doubts about the challenges he'd taken on or whatever mess he was currently in. Biggest of all was the promise he'd made at the glacier to Buddy when she had asked him, "Will you stop the warming?" The innocence and pleading in her eyes made him realize how mountain goats, like other living things, were victims of forces far beyond their control. Her request had made his heart race, and he thought, "It's impossible. I'm just a sixth grader with a science project and a fear of talking in front of class. How can I stop the climate from warming and keep a glacier from melting?" He had swallowed hard and said to Buddy at the glacier, "Buddy, I will try. I really will to help keep your home safe." So that kind of gives, your audience an idea of the concept of the book and what's going on.
And I think that certainly sums up the premise of the promise. And so, if folks are inspired by the interview, how can they get a hold of a copy as it comes out the day we will be broadcasting this?
Right now, I know it's available for pre-order on Amazon. I don't know if it's on other websites yet, like IndieBound and Bookshop and some of the others where you can buy it. You can order it from your local bookstore right now. They won't probably have it on the shelf yet, but they can order it in for you. And then hopefully a lot of bookstores will have it on their shelves before long. And I just add one thing, Phil. This series and books like it have such an important message for kids nowadays that I'm really hoping that we can get these kinds of books into school libraries everywhere, because it's a great way of kids to learn about STEM, the sciences in particular, in a way that's engaging for them through storytelling. So that's my hope for librarians and teachers, to bring it into schools.
It's a great vision, though. What's your next book project, or are you able to say yet?
Now you're sounding like my wife.
Yeah, or your
She
publisher.
asked me that. She asked me that kind of weekly. It's funny. This is the first time in 20 years I haven't been writing a book, and sometimes I had two going at the same time. I wrap this up, and I just have such a focus right now on making this available to readers. Doing school visits, other presentations, interviews like yours, whatever, because it's so important for me right now to get this in the hands of readers. So that has kind of stalled out my reading inertia. So we'll have to see what's coming later.
Certainly, there's work to be done to get the word out on it. While we have you on the radio here, because I know one of your motivations for writing this is to share information about the current state of climate change and its impact on glaciers and in general on its impact in our region throughout Montana and Idaho and the rest of the Pacific Northwest, Inland Northwest. And the state of mountain goats. Let's touch at least briefly on where we're at and your observations as a scientist in regards to the impacts and rapidity with which we're seeing climate change impact our landscape.
Well, the glaciers, and of course, glaciers were a perfect, again, gateway to talking about the climate crisis in the series. Glaciers are such an obvious manifestation of how the climate is affecting our world. They're kind of the canary in the coal mine because we can see them. We can measure the changes, the recession of these glaciers. And There are 198,000 plus or minus terrestrial glaciers in the world. Every continent except Australia, they lost their glaciers long, long ago. And those glaciers have about 2% of all the ice on the planet. The rest of it is locked up in the huge continental ice sheets, is what I'm trying to say, on Antarctica and Greenland. That's where 98% of the ice is. And as it starts to melt, of course, we know that it raises sea level. That's just one thing that's happening. Of those 198,000 glaciers, excluding the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, it's projected now from the models from what scientists have been learning over the recent decades that possibly half of those glaciers will be gone by the end of the century. Some glaciers, just in the last 100 years, have lost 80% of their ice. And one close to home example of that is Glacier National Park in Montana. In 1850, when it was first explored and mapped, there were 150 named glaciers in the park. When the park was established as a national park in 1910, almost all of them were still there out of that 150. Today, there are 25. And most of that ice has disappeared since 1970 when the first Earth Day was celebrated.
And
And it's projected by a number of glaciologists, geologists, including Dan Fager, who was the glaciologist in Glacier since 1991, I think, that by the end of this decade, none of those glaciers will exist anymore. There'll be ice, there'll be some permanent snow fields left, but they won't categorically be glaciers anymore. So Glacier will be Unglacier National Park. And that's happening in the Cascades, it's happening elsewhere in the Rocky Mountains, it's happening all through Canada. Alaska is really losing its glaciers fast. Because the farther you go towards the poles, the faster the climate is warming. But whether you're in the Alps, and I took a trip to Switzerland last year to trek through the Alps and see what was happening there. Oh, the ice is melting so rapidly in the Alps. I hiked on areas at 11,000 feet where 30 years before there was a glacier and it was 200 yards away from me. And where I was hiking, where there had been that ice 30 years before, I would have been on, feet and feet of ice, and that's how quickly it's receded. So anyway, this is something that's happening worldwide, and anywhere from 2 to 4 billion people depend upon that water for their domestic use, for agriculture and other sources of necessary water. And of course, lots of wildlife and plants do as well.
So there's so much that we can do, and a lot of it starts with simply becoming more learned on the topic. And a great place to start is this trilogy of books you've written. The Promise, due out this week, The Legend Keepers, The Promise. Again, a great capping stone to all three. I highly encourage readers who haven't to start at the beginning and read through, because the third book makes a whole lot more sense in its order. Anything else you'd like to talk about while we're wrapping things up here, Bruce?
No, it was a great interview. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your audience.
All right. Well, if you've just tuned in to the morning show, this morning we've been talking with Bruce Smith, a scientist, wildlife biologist, author of many books, including the three parts of the Legend Keeper series. The most recent, third in the trilogy, is The Promise, due out this week. Check your local favorite book site for that. And if you've missed any of the interview and would like to listen to it all, you can go to krfy.org and click on the podcast page to listen to the interview in its entirety. Thank you for coming on the show this morning, Bruce.
Thank you.